Hello, and welcome to Distillery Sessions, the podcast from Distillery. My name is Peter Hoffer, and I will be your host for today's Distillery Session. Now, today I am joined by Adam G., commissioning editor, producer, new talent consultant at Little Dot Studios, Red Bull Media House, among others. And today we are talking about commissioning content for fans. Welcome, Adam.
Hi, thank you very much for having me.
No, my pleasure. It's great to have you on the podcast. I think we will have plenty to talk about when it comes to commissioning content for fans. And definitely look forward to this session. So perhaps to start us off, could you tell us a bit about your background, Adam?
Sure. I've been working as a commissioning editor for quite a long time, for 13 years at Channel 4 in London, mainly focusing on multi-platform commissioning, so working out how to integrate TV with web, mobile, and real life. And after Channel 4, I went to work at Little Dot Studios to be their first commissioner of original content, and that was focused on Real Stories, which is their documentary channel. Mm-hmm. So quite a sort of shift in that I was heading in a online direction deliberately. So Real Stories has sort of 3.5 million subscribers on YouTube and is focused on YouTube and Facebook, really, as their platforms. And it was really liberating in a way to enter a world that was more driven by accurate metrics, data, and a real ability to see what your audience looked like in mm-hmm. a granular way. And after that, in the last sort of year and a half, I've been working for Red Bull Media House, commissioning directorial talent that is distinctive creatively and fresh. So really, it was about bringing original, fresh storytelling to the amazing brand that is Red Bull, and just people coming from a different kind of angle from normal. So not coming from, say, the specifics of any particular sport or extreme sport, but people that are coming at it from a storytelling point of view. So that's very much my kind of territory. I'm interested in how you tell stories most effectively in video and online and in multi-platform. And I'm a bit cautious about the term storytelling these days, because it's been somewhat cheapened. I think everyone's a storyteller, everyone's got a story to tell, and it's become cliched or a bit tired. But narrative is really kind of central to how you get content to work and how you get fans to engage and enjoy the content and spread it around. So I don't really make any apologies for storytelling. I'm not using it in a kind of cheap or thoughtless way.
Yeah, I think it's quite funny that you do bring up storytelling, because it seems to be almost a buzzword now that, you know, as you said, has lost its meaning when it comes to telling people's stories. Have you found, potential clients in your past that when you do push forward a narrative structure as opposed to a pure brand placement, that there's a bit of confusion, a bit of nervousness of going down that narrative approach?
No, I haven't really had any kind of pushback on it once people see what it can look like, because there's quite a range that you can cover within that description of narrative driven content. So for example, film that I've been working on recently that came out a few weeks ago called They Saw the Sun First is a really unusual stylized form of, I would still call it documentary, but many people might not.
Mm.
Because it's told through the medium of dance, but it's still using documentary material in the sense that you get that the main characters are voices that have been recorded in a traditional documentary way, but then the voices have been given to dancers to interpret. And there's I'd really kind of encourage people to have a look at that. So it's called They Saw the Sun First, and it's on Red Bull website and other places. And it sort of goes to show what the kind of breadth can be within narrative driven content. It's not a narrow proposal. It allows for a lot of room for maneuver.
Yes. It seems that that type of relationship, that you have, for example, with Red Bull is definitely built on trust from both sides. Has that do you see Red Bull as being unique in that regards of, realizing the power of that type of storytelling?
No, not unique, but I think they were enlightened to spot the fact that it would be a useful injection of fresh blood into the organization and into the content. So I think, they were definitely enlightened to have that strategy, and they've been very open in terms of the people that I've brought to the party. And sure. Even though it wasn't particularly part of the brief, what I'm particularly proud of the initiative that I've been doing there, which is called Storytellers, mm-hmm. is that 46% of the directorial talent has been female, and the same percentage has been non-white. And also of the first 11 directors that were commissioned, they all came from different countries. If you break the UK down into four countries, which you're on fairly safe territory to do these days. But, the point is it was very kind of internationalist, which was much more actually on the brief. That part of it was made very clear. They're very keen to get people from all around the world. So we've got directors from everywhere, from Brooklyn to Sydney to Wales to I've run out of places, from really quite a sort of spread of places. And then so that's one of the most exciting things, is that we've got so many different kinds of perspectives and people with so many different kinds of experience.
No, that is, I think it, in lines of current events, having that diversity of voices, diversity of perspectives can, only make it a stronger statement, stronger stories, and can better represent the fans that, Red Bull, for example, want to reach out to.
Absolutely. And the thing about this particular gig is that I was originally hired for exactly that reason. They saw the diversity of voices on the Real Stories originals that I'd done at Little Dot, and they asked if I could sort of bring something similar to bear at Red Bull. And I've made a sort of speciality of finding talent, creative and visual talent, in unusual places. So you can't just rock up at some film school and expect to come away with someone extraordinary. It's quite a sort of handcrafted process, mm-hmm. but people are pleasantly surprised all the time at the quality of talent that seems to appear from kind of nowhere, that's just not on people's radars.
Yeah, I guess it is just that reminder for everyone to leave as many doors open as possible, and the talent will rise.
For sure. And also, it's important to show a certain openness, because, we talk about diversity in terms of ethnicity and gender a lot. But for example, when I started the job, I think there was an expectation that the directors I brought to bear would all be kind of emerging 23-year-olds. But the reality is the average age of the directors on the initiative has been 28. And I don't think it's accidental that they're at a certain stage of their career where they've kind of proven they've got what it takes, and they've done one or two really good pieces. But there's still room for them to be nurtured and taken up a gear or two. So, you know, the oldest, and I would contend, you know, one of the best directors we worked with was 32. Mm-hmm. And the youngest was 21, and they both were kind of exciting to work with for completely different reasons. But the one thing they had in common across the age range was a total and utter commitment to their films. And I guess that is the territory that I like to inhabit, where people are absolutely committed to the content that they're making and put their heart and soul into it. And it's not kind of commoditized, and it's not some company just kind of banging out another, you know, short this or short that. It's people sure. that are very kind of committed to what they're doing. And that's what fires me up.
Hmm. Gotcha. Could we, I guess, take a step to talk about the actual process of commissioning? So, you know, you mentioned earlier of Red Bull providing a brief. Is that how most of these projects start, with a traditional brief, or does it come about through conversations or other ways? How does, you know, how do you get a project kicked off?
Yeah, I mean, it's kind of all of those things. So let me give you a kind of a quick sort of potted history of that. So at Channel 4, I would work with an open brief, partly because it's public service broadcaster. So
okay,
I think there's more of a moral imperative to keep it open to a wide range of suppliers. So the problem with that is a massive amount of your time gets absorbed just sifting through a lot of, without wanting to be impolite, dross to find yes. where the bits of gold are. So it's not a very efficient way of doing it. So when I went to Little Dot, I deliberately changed my approach because I could. It's a privately held indie based in London with offices in LA and Munich. And it's got a massive reach. It publishes 5 billion views worth of video content every month. That's 5 billion views per month. And that's from a, you know, from a UK privately held indie. Anyway, because it is privately held, I felt I didn't have an obligation to make the brief open in that way. So what I did was I constructed a brief based on data, which I'll come back to.
Okay.
And then put it out in a limited way to people that I either knew to work with and really reckoned, or people that I really wanted to work with and had sort of, you know, watched from afar. And then, you know, other people that crossed my paths where I thought, oh, yeah, they'd be perfect. But there was nothing kind of fully open about it. It was very selective, so that I had a limited amount of incoming stuff to deal with, and most of my energies went into the actual films. And then at Red Bull, very similar kind of thing, really, but in some ways even more so, because I was proactively in search of directorial talent. So all the time I was spotting people, doing my kind of due diligence and research, and then approaching them. So it was more like Little Dot than it was like Channel 4. Now, just going back to the question of data,
yep.
I would say that the brief at Little Dot was data shaped, because the first thing I did when I arrived there was I just went through the back end of the YouTube channel and just got a solid sense of what had worked for the channel to date, who was watching, and a real kind of data-informed view of who the fans were. And then I shaped the brief accordingly without being kind of slavish to it, but I was able to say, look, here are a number of areas that work for us. And I made it clear, like, this is not carved in stone. You don't have to address these, but these are the ones that are proven to work.
Mm-hmm.
And not everything was commissioned out of those areas, but a lot of people, you know, paid attention to that and addressed, addressed what the data showed. And what's very interesting, you know, I was telling you about the scale of Little Dot, and what's very interesting is that the way that business got up and running was by paying attention to data. So Little Dot was providing as a service, basically kind of IP protection in the earlier days of YouTube, and just watching out for piracy. And they noticed what people were pirating. And one of the things that they noticed was one of the most pirated things that was appearing on YouTube was long form documentaries were very popular, I think second only to children's stuff. So they actually set up Real Stories in November 2015 off the back of those insights, that because everyone, you know, the received wisdom was, oh, people don't want to watch anything long form. They just want like short bite-sized bits of stuff. Yeah. But that's not what the data was showing. So they went about acquiring lots of long form content, documentary content that was kind of sitting in people's cupboards doing nothing. And they reinvigorated it, and they, you know, they squeezed the juice out of these amazing documentaries that largely had been made for broadcasters, but had sort of gone out once or twice and then, you know, just went into someone's cupboard and just dropped off the radar. So, you know, that the business is completely springboarding from data, and so did the content commissioning.
And I imagine it's much easier for you to, you know, make your recommendations when you have that data in your back pocket to show that it's not just, you know, finger in the air, these are my recommendations, but by actually showing the behavioral, you know, online behavior of these fans, I can imagine it's makes your case much stronger.
It does make your case stronger, but at the same time, you have to leave some room for, call it what you will, instinct, or kind of, you know, instinct is kind of informed by years of experience.
Yes.
So it's not really kind of, it's not really that risky in a way, because it's something that's been developed over a long time. But there is, you know, it's important to have room for that. So it's interesting, for example, at Little Dot, the most successful film that I commissioned there was a film called In Your Face, which was about tattoos, facial tattoos and neck tattoos and prejudice against them. And that film, by the time I left Little Dot, had done 100 million views in about 10 months. And wow. Since then, it's actually done many times more than that on all, you know, that's on all platforms.
Yes.
But the point about it is, it's the only film that I commissioned there where I went against the usual thing, which is, you know, you normally look for the ideas from the indies, or, you know, from the people commissioned to make the content. But in this particular case, it was just a sort of a thing that crossed my path that I thought would be good. So I saw this book, which when I was in New York, about a photographer who had photographed mainly gang members, but people with facial tattoos, and then spent tens of hours photoshopping them out. And then after I saw that book, when I got back to London, I saw a video that he'd done where he'd shown the subjects of the photos what they looked like when they were cleaned up. Mm-hmm. And they were all kind of crying and reacting very emotionally, because it was sort of the path not traveled and what their lives could have been like if they'd have just taken a different turn somewhere.
Yeah.
So I saw that and I thought, wow, that would be so fun to do as a video thing rather than as a, you know, as a static photo project. But also, you know, it would be good to see what does that look like in the UK, where people with facial tattoos aren't so closely associated with gangs. It's much more diverse than that. Mm-hmm. So I actually took that idea out to an indie that I'd worked with before that I knew would be into that kind of subject. And also because it involved, you know, we couldn't Photoshop out the tattoos, so we had to make up out the tattoos. And I'd done a film at Channel 4 called, or series rather, called Naked and Invisible, that involved a lot of makeup. In that case, it was to kind of render people invisible in their environment. But, you know, because we'd worked on a makeup-oriented thing before, and we had a really great makeup artist, Caroline Roper, to bring on board, I took the idea out to Show 'em Entertainment, and They came up with a great format to realize this idea and turn it into a sort of social experiment where we just checked out sort of semi-scientifically the difference between people's reactions to the same people when they did or didn't have tattoos. So it's kind of a fun social experiment with, you know, with something to say at the same time. So that was unusual, to, you know, to take out an idea to an indie, but it, you know, it happens from time to time, and it's fine as part of the mix. But by and large, you want it to go the other way. But anyway, so but it was purely a sort of based on instinct. I mean, I'd made at that point it was my 50th tattoo film. So and they'd all been pretty successful. So I knew it was a gift that kept on giving. But this one, you know, just went up another gear. It was, you know, turned out to be a great film. You know, what's interesting was when we came to do a follow-up film, we were perfectly conscious of the fact that it isn't science. Like, you need a bit of luck with these things, as well as much science as you could bring to it. So we analyzed the data very carefully. We were very clear what people liked and didn't like about the original film and where they engaged and where they didn't engage. And we kind of shaped the follow-up film based on that sort of granular data of the specifics of how people watched the first film. Mm-hmm. And, you know, we did a good job, and Even More in Your Face, which was the follow-up film, did very well, but it didn't kind of work on the same scale as In Your Face did originally. And, you know, that's just how it is. I mean, I remember at Little Dot hearing about there was a video that was kind of was released on a Monday morning at a certain time, kind of by mistake. It was supposed to come out the following week. So they ended up, so it came out on that Monday and it didn't really do anything. And when the next Monday came along, they just re-released it exactly the same way at exactly the same time. And it went absolutely bonkers and it was a real kind of viral success. And it was the same material at the same time on the same platform, which is a fairly good kind of illustration, as you sort of just need a little bit of luck sometimes as well.
Sure.
To just, you know, just be out there at the right time and catch the right communities, and then things take off. So all you can really do is optimize things to be as spreadable and shareable and engageable with as possible. And then you also have to, you know, accept that part of the equation is that little bit of luck. And sometimes it's with you and sometimes it isn't. And you just have to accept that.
Yeah, I guess that's the way of all filmmaking. I think, you know, we've all seen examples of one Hollywood hit coming out and then many dozen copycats coming out within a year afterwards that, you know, some may be a success, but others just, you know, despite hitting all the major points of the formula, just doesn't resonate.
Yeah, I mean, that's a similar kind of thing, but not absolutely identical, because I'm talking about literally the same content at the same time on the same platform, which obviously that doesn't happen too often, but it's a good it's a good yardstick for the fact that that you can't just put it down to science.
Sure.
I mean, I love that. I don't know if you spotted it or got a chance to read it, but I loved the book that came out last year by Rory Sutherland called Alchemy. He's the vice chair of Ogilvy UK, I think I've got his title right. And he obviously writes a lot on creativity and innovation and so forth. And one of the things that really resonated for me was because I started reading it, and it was just at the same time that I started at Red Bull. And he opens the book, which is basically an argument that you can't run your content creation or your advertising on purely rational, logical terms, because that isn't really how it works. Mm-hmm. And he starts off by talking, he gives the very first page is a case study on Red Bull, where I just started. And he said, he says sort of, you know, if you were going to go head to head with Coke, you know, what would you do? You'd come up with something that's in an even bigger bottle and even better value for money, and that tastes better, etc., etc. You know, that's the logic. And then he sort of brings us back down to earth by saying, well, you know, the people that have made inroads into Coke's market is Red Bull, which comes in a really small can. It's fairly expensive and its taste is questionable, shall we say. You know, it's a matter of personal preference. But so, you know, there's no logic behind why Red Bull should have been so successful in eroding Coke's market. You have to look more carefully than that. And I think one of the fascinating things about Red Bull is that it's got such a coherent brand. Like, people that drink it and equally people that don't drink it, if you ask them what's the Red Bull lifestyle, they all pretty much know, particularly of a certain generation, but, you know, really across quite a broad range of demographics. Whereas that's something that Coke has never been able to do, really, to have a coherent image where you sort of know exactly what Coke lifestyle means. You know, there's been periods in the 70s when I guess there were kind of ads that sort of kind of caught the public imagination, and I'd like to teach the world to sing and things like that. Yeah. But even that doesn't really give you a coherent lifestyle in the way that Red Bull have managed to communicate. So it is a fascinating brand.
I imagine that, you know, a brand like Red Bull will do extensive, you know, research into their fans, not just quant data or survey data or video analysis, but perhaps interviews or just speaking to them at these events. How much of that, I guess, that rich research is, are you privy to that helps your decisions when it comes to commissioning content and crafting that content?
I mean, I had access to a certain amount of it, but to be honest, because of the nature of what I was doing, the commissions were more a space for people to show off what they can do in terms of storytelling that's distinctive and dynamic. And it wasn't to produce typical Red Bull content. That's kind of the next stage, that once they've shown off what they can do, you can then deploy this directorial talent in traditional Red Bull areas. So it's kind of a slightly weird example and doesn't exactly match what you're kind of questioning me about. I think Little Dot is a better example, where all of that data was totally sort of freely available and easy to access and easy to apply to the end products. Whereas, you know, it's slightly different kind of brief and slightly different kind of rationale behind what I've been doing at Red Bull. So the Little Dot is a more typical example. And, you know, you can't know too much about your fans or your potential fans. It's all useful stuff. And as with any kind of deep research, you know, when you're kind of writing a book and you've been researching something for months and months and months in extreme detail, there's a certain point where it actually pays to let go of the detail. It's kind of in your head. What matters is in your head, and you go on and create the content or write the book. You know, you don't want to be constantly referring back to it. You want to kind of absorb it and then let it inform what you're doing. I think you know, when I think of the kind of roots of this, really, for me, it was probably in the notion of user-centered design as applied on multi-platform projects at Channel 4. So I think that was the first place where, in a kind of coherent, highly structured way, I found myself going out to talk to fans and potential fans and get their insights before locking down content. Because obviously with TV, you have a broad sense of who your fans are. But it is pretty broad because of the way that it's traditionally been measured, and it's not really kind of, it's kind of a measurement that's kind of extrapolated, and it's sort of a bit rough around the edges, and it's certainly not got the precision of digital data. But I worked on a multi-platform series at Channel 4 about photography. So it was kind of a photographic competition along the lines of all the kind of talent competitions that we know and love these days. It was called Picture This, and what was interesting about it was when we went to build the multi-platform aspect of the project, we did it on principles of user-centered design. So obviously it was a competition about how to be a good and a program series about how to be a good photographer, and what we wanted to do was basically to enable everybody out there to try the same photo tasks that they were seeing each week in the series. So it might be like documentary photography or low light photography or whatever. I can't remember exactly what the tasks were, but we replicated them online, and it was a really useful experience for me because I was working with a company called Mint Digital, who actually have just come back into being after a sort of hiatus of a little while the sort of founders went off and did some other things. And we started exploring, you know, how we thought we would do the online aspect of the project. And we sat down with a bunch of potential, you know, people in the target audience, and kicked around what we had in mind and what was, and we built some sort of prototypes and played around with it and let them play around with it. And what was very striking for me was they came back and they made it really clear that they didn't have the confidence to self-publish their photographs online. And they felt quite intimidated by that. So at the time, there would have been a big audience online that was busy using Flickr, who was our partner on that project, and similar websites to publish their photography and to improve their photography and to be in a photographic community. But most of the people we spoke to felt really intimidated by that, and they were not from that kind of hardcore, most proactive end of the audience. So we really took that on board, and we constructed a site that you could participate in that was kind of constructive and sort of shielded. So we set up a kind of community ethos where, and also, you know, facilities within the actual site where basically you were encouraged to give constructive feedback, not to be too harsh, not to be show-offy, but to actually help people improve their photography and to focus on you know, the specifics of what they'd done well and what they could improve and how they could improve it. And that was very much the kind of tone of the site when it was actually launched. You know, it was a very constructive and positive place, and there wasn't grandstanding and there wasn't putting down. It was exactly, you know, we ended up being able to deliver exactly what people had described. So, you know, the whole ethos of the site was determined by the what were potential fans and then became fans. And a similar thing happened actually when we did a big sex education site called Sexperience at Channel 4. But we quickly learned from actually talking to the core audience, which was teenage audience, that they didn't much like kind of experts in terms of, you know, in terms of sexual area and self-help and that sort of territory. Sure. They much preferred to learn from their peers. So we ended up creating a really successful site that became very successful sort of internationally, which was very much a kind of peer-to-peer experience. So people were sharing what did and didn't and had and hadn't worked for them in real life. And there were no experts on there. And people were respected to the degree that they could, you know, read things that might even be kind of contradictory, and they could make up their own mind as to who they wanted to listen to and whose experience kind of resonated for them. So again, really the DNA of the site had been established by what the fans and potential fans actually wanted and the way they thought about the subject.
Now with that sex ed example, was there a bit of nervousness on the client part where, you know, initially they had a vision in mind of what this interactive, you know, platform
I mean, bear in mind, so, you know, so Channel 4 is a public service broadcaster, and it has a young audience. So, you know, it's a perfectly legitimate area for the channel to be involved in, and it had a lot of TV programming in that area at the time. So really good things like the Sex Education Show with Anna Richardson, which was a really great sort of a fresh approach to the area. So, and obviously Channel 4's used to doing kind of risky stuff, but nonetheless, obviously there's a nervousness around it, and especially because if you think through the sort of logic of it, you actually need to be addressing relatively young teens that are going to be interested in this area and that needed to be able to find out stuff in this area. So I have to say it showed off the best of Channel 4 and the best of Channel 4 compliance lawyers, because the lawyer that worked on it was an absolute kind of enabler, which is what the best sort of Channel 4 compliance lawyers are like. You know, they find the way to help you realize your creative vision in a way that's both kind of legally acceptable and reputationally acceptable. And one of the things that they did, you know, if you're going to do that, you have to be entirely consistent. So, and your case has to be sort of rock solid and consistent. And one of the things that they did was they actually changed the terms of the whole of channel4.com to accommodate this project. Because prior to this project, you had to be 16 or over to contribute any content, such as comments on channel4.com. But they lowered the age in response to this project because they needed to present an absolutely kind of rock solid and thoroughly coherent case for why they were doing what they were doing. And that was part of the picture. You know, if someone came along, like, say, Ofcom, and they saw that actually a 13-year-old can't ask a question on this site, then they can start to kind of pick holes in it because it's clearly not really doing what it's intended to do. I see. That was a great example, both of, you know, we've talked a bit about enlightened commissioning at Red Bull, and this is kind of another area of kind of enlightened program making at Channel 4, where the whole organization is teed up to deliver the best and the freshest creative visions. And that's what they enabled us to do in that case.
Oh, sounds like a fantastic ending to that project, to be able to open up to even more younger people.
Yeah, I mean, it was, you know, it's not that it was targeted at young people, but for, you know, for the rationale of it to make sense, they had to be able to access it and to engage with it. But it was used by people across a broad range of demographics. But it was a, you know, it was a great project because even though it was kind of UK focused, it took root across the world. You know, clearly was helping a lot of people. And so on that level, you know, it was very much in line with Channel 4's public service remit without looking like a kind of worthy thing.
Sure. Okay. So it looks like we are coming close to our time with this episode. But before we leave, I wanted to ask a couple quick questions that, you know, we ask all of our interviewees at the distillery sessions. So Adam, what was the last thing you recommended to a friend or family member? You know, this could be something like a, you know, a TV show, a new band, a new recipe.
Okay, you're going to have to let me think about these a tiny bit, because I'm the kind of guy that spends, you know, a month trying to work out their desert island disc. So the last thing I recommended, sorry, I know I've recommended stuff this week and I'm desperately trying to remember what it was. Well, it's a weird one actually, but I'll say it anyway. The last thing I actually recommended was a Netflix drama called White Lines, which I've been watching the last week for some kind of light relief. But I recommended it really, on the grounds that it had a lot of Spanish in it, and it was to someone that was busy learning Spanish, so I thought they'd enjoy it, you know, hearing colloquial contemporary Spanish in the context of that story. But it's actually not a great drama. It's perfectly kind of entertaining, but it's kind of silly at the same time. But I do recommend a lot of things to a lot of people, because I think that's one of the real pleasures of how we're all connected these days. Oh, actually, I've just remembered the main thing that I recommended, because I knew I'd done a lot of recommending this week. So I might change my answer, or maybe you'll be kind enough to include both of them. The one that was really kind of a hearty recommendation was, I've been joining in Tim Burgess of The Charlatans has been running this thing called Tim's Listening Parties online. So everyone takes to Twitter at a certain time, and they listen to a particular record together. So we all push the sort of play button at the same time, and then just kind of just lose ourselves in an exchange of memories and reactions and just thoughts around the music. So last night's one was True by Spandau Ballet, which was very enjoyable. It's not a record that I particularly listened to when it came out, not that particular one, but I do enjoy their stuff. And last night's discussion was great because there were so many interesting people on it, just, you know, regular people, and then Gary Kemp from Spandau Ballet joined in the conversation. So it was really nice to be, you know, when having Gary like your tweet and you think, yeah, that was fun joining in that. Because it's that thing, isn't it? You know, just bringing us back to fans, you know, the fact that fans can be in such close contact with the people that they're fans of is just amazing. You know, it's lovely to exchange stuff with Gary Kemp. It was lovely last week to exchange stuff with both Tim Burgess and Lol Tolhurst, the guitarist from The Cure, because we all listened to Faith last week, and it's a total kind of kick. So that's all that's best about the internet. Wow, what a long answer to a quick fire question, sorry.
No, but it's a great way, I think, especially now, for us to make connections if we're all stuck in our studios or our homes. You know, being able to do something like that, it's like a shared event, a shared experience, which you know, doesn't happen too often, fortunately.
Yeah, you know, that is it. It was just a lovely communal experience, and the vibe was just all around you know, benign, and everyone got in the spirit of it so well. So tonight I will be listening to a Pogues album in exactly the same way at 10 o'clock.
Fantastic. And finally, what are you a fan of that might surprise most people? Now, this could be something like, you know, professional wrestling or baking sourdough bread.
Okay, well, I'm afraid my answer is going to be really nerdy. but weirdly, I go to a seminar once a month on Finnegan's Wake, the James Joyce novel, which is basically... looks like complete gibberish when you open the book, and I thought for many years that it was complete gibberish, and the only reason I engaged with it was because I'm a big fan of Ulysses, the novel that preceded it, which is also, it's quite hard, but it's readable.
Yes.
Finnegan's Wake just looks like a code book. So I ended up going to these seminars, and it's now been a couple of years that I've been going to the seminars and reading the book really kind of closely with a bunch of people. So just literally, I've been doing it, I think, for 2 years, and we've read 9.5 pages in 2 years. We literally, like, once a month on a Friday night, 2 hours, we get through about 10 lines. But it's super interesting. And then the great thing about the lockdown was, so we transferred the seminar online. It's usually at Senate House at University of London, but we tried it on some lesser software than Zoom, and it worked fine, and everyone was, well, you know, the kind of authorities were kind of pleased with how well it had gone and how many people showed up and how it kind of worked online. So we've doubled the frequency of our meetings, and we meet every couple of weeks. Gosh, I've forgotten where I was going with that. Just bear with me a second. Might have to chop this bit out. Oh, yeah, sorry. So after the first online meeting, I was kind of flicking through the book and I went back because we're looking at a bit that's like quite near the end of the book.
Yeah.
I went back to look at the beginning of the book, which, you know, 2 years ago I'd looked at and I was like, I will never be able to read this. I have no idea what this is. It's like a foreign language. But I went back to look at the beginning of the book and I discovered that I can now read this. And it was a great kind of discovery, and it kind of just shows why it's worth like studying stuff and learning from people, because it's been so with the lockdown. I think I'm about 150 pages into the book now, which I've just read on my own and suddenly realized I can actually read it. But if you care to go and have a look online, for example, at James Joyce digital website, and you have a quick look at the text of Finnegan's Wake, you'll see what I mean. I mean, it's total kind of gibberish and looks completely impenetrable. But after, you know, effectively kind of without realizing it, learning how to read it, I've been able to kind of plow my way through. So that's kind of my biggest achievement of the lockdown. And also that's my weirdest kind of fan thing, because I've got no Irish connections. I do like books and reading and sort of literature. So I guess, you know, that's where that comes from. But it's pretty nerdy, isn't it? Sorry.
No, I mean, I finally managed to get through Ulysses late last year. And I mean, as you said, it is readable. There are a few sections that my mind struggled a bit. There's a few sort of dream sections that it was harder to understand than others. But I haven't made my way through Finnegan's Wake yet, but might be inspired to give it a go.
Well, next time you're kind of locked in for 10 weeks, it might be worth thinking about. But as far as Ulysses is concerned, the trick with that, as to some degree with Finnegan's Wake, is you have to kind of let some of it just flow over you. Not struggle to understand every word and every line, but kind of just go with the flow. So, you know, that's true of lots of different kinds of art, I guess.
Yeah. Well, so thank you, Adam, for joining me today. And I want to thank everyone for listening to this episode. Now, if you want to follow Distillery on our socials, you can find us at We Are Distillery. And Adam, if people wanted to contact you, what's the best way?
I'm fairly easy to find online. I'm mainly under the name Archangel, which is Arkangel, which is the name of my company. But otherwise, well, I'll give you my email, which is adam@archangel.co.uk. The Archangel is spelt wrong. It's spelt with a K, Arkangel. And I am at Surreal Thing on Twitter.
Gotcha. All right. Well, thank you again, everyone. And we hope to welcome you to our next episode of Distillery Session soon. Thanks, everyone.
Thank you.